people on the path can develop these incredible shadow sides as by pursuing an ideal of perfection, they then push down the sides of themselves that don't meet with their ideal of perfection. And I've seen that in myself and every single one of my colleagues more times than I can count, because the spiritual marketplace is so full of perfection models. They're just everywhere in nearly every tradition, the sense of exalted sainthood or, you know, pick your favorite ideal of what this will lead to, that all of us have these internalized in some way that even if we intellectually say, oh yeah, I don't actually intellectually believe that, it's an emotional level they've gotten in. They've gotten into all of us, and we have to wrestle with that.
Welcome to episode 33 of the Mind That Ego podcast. I'm Ricky DeRiz, and today I'm joined by Dr. Daniel Ingram. Daniel's book, Mastering the Core Teachings of the Buddha, is well known in spiritual circles due, in part, to a mixture of practical instruction, lucid insight, useful maps, and common sense. His teachings are controversial to some, compelling for many, mostly due to his bold declaration that enlightenment is an attainable goal once our fanciful notions of it are stripped away. My interest in Daniel's work is that he's clearly one of the most advanced meditation experts alive today, with profound insight matched by a down-to-earth approach that has consideration for common misconceptions, false promises, ego traps, and the dark side of awakening. Our illuminating conversation is inspired by the relationship between awakening and meaning. We cover mental health, the value of Western psychology and the blind spots of Eastern traditions, perfectionist models, why not all meditative skills are transferable, synchronicity and the nature of the now, the world of experience versus the world of meaning, the dark side of wizardry, and the usefulness of philosophy and concepts, plus much, much more. I'm really looking forward to this because I went back over Mastering the Core Teachings of the Buddha and also looked at a few of your talks and interviews. And to be honest, I already feel like 90 minutes probably isn't long enough, but we'll see.
It's been commonly noted.
Yeah. There's so much. And I think to help focus and create some kind of linearity to the discussion, I know we mentioned briefly in our last conversation, the dance between self-realization and meaning. So maybe we could explore self-realization, meaning, and also morality, because that was something that stood out in your book as essential that I feel is overlooked quite a lot. So maybe if I just drop in those three keywords, and I wonder if you maybe to begin, if you give a brief background. I'm sure you've done it many times, but just for Mind That Ego listeners that aren't so familiar, a brief background of how you got involved in this work and the different kind of tracks of your own development and practice.
Yeah, all right. So people have seen me talk about this before. I usually talk about what I call the three Daniels. And Daniel number one is this kid who started having peaceful, blissful meditative experiences at around age 3 or 4, and then lost that ability for unknown reasons. Had my first lucid flying dream at age 5. I still remember it very clearly. It was a remarkable moment. And then in the weird hippie Quaker school, Carolina Friends School, I went to in Durham, North Carolina for 2nd through 4th grade, I got some basic instruction in visualization, meditation, and some progressive relaxation, standard stuff like squeeze your toes and feel the light coming in and relax and, you know, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So then at age 14 or 15, I know this by the house we lived in at the time because we moved a lot when I was a kid, I had my first, you know, explosion of consciousness, which you might call Kundalini opening or an energetic, I don't know, something, pick your favorite name for it. And then traveled out of my body for the first time shortly thereafter, the standard lift out, you know, look down, see yourself there, float through the wall, freak out, snap back, buzz and paralysis. And what the heck was that? The whole thing couldn't have been more than 5 seconds, but it was striking, right? It's like, whoa, something you remember. And then I started having weird energetic and mood and other stuff happening to me after that I would later call things like the stages of insight. And 10 years later, ran into people who had gone on intensive meditation retreats and started going on retreats, and then was off and running. And, you know, wrote a book and hung out a shingle in the late 90s and said, if you're having weird meditative, spiritual, psychedelic, energetic, et cetera, experiences, I'll talk to you about those for free and won't even take a donation. Been doing that for 26 years. And also co-founded the Dharma Overground, which is a big online community of people who talk about this stuff with Vince Horn. And, you know, that's been running since what, 2008 or something. And then somewhere around there. So that's a pretty long time and thousands of forum posts about the wild end of the path. Mm-hmm. And then that also gave me a fascinating friend circle. We get to share the journey of this strange adventure through a lot of different traditions and lenses and perspectives. So that's been cool. And so that's Daniel number one. And somewhere in there, I became what I roughly term a meditative athlete, like learning to do states and stages and stuff. And then Daniel number two is this kid who was like School of Science and Math and pre-med and electrical engineering and public health school, infectious disease epidemiology, and MD, emergency medicine, also then healthcare administration, working mostly in major level one trauma centers and psych referral centers with kids and adults. And then I retired from that about 5 years ago. And then 4 years ago, Dr. Julieta Galante, who's an MD, PhD with public health degree as well, is a postdoc at Cambridge University, invited me to come help her start a project that wanted to help upgrade the clinical mainstream's relationship to the deep end of human experience, broadly defined what most people would call spiritual, mystical, magical, energetic, and psychedelic phenomena, and we call emergent phenomena. And then this fascinating friend circle I had accumulated was like, hey, that sounds like fun too. And so we all banded together to, you know, a lot of people had this interest before, but just didn't really have the mechanism. And then we sort of emerged as one of the mechanisms to do that and gathered together to be the change we wanted to see in the world. And that's when Daniel 3, as I call it, really began to emerge. And it was like, how can the clinical world, which basically looks at Daniel 1 and says that's crazy, needs meds, you know, have a much better understanding of this. And as my Harvard, Yale, Harvard trained pediatrician father, you know, professor father now admits, had I told him what was going on when I was 14 or 15, he would have done something really dumb and harmful to me. Like, you know, thinking that was the right thing to do, and probably would have, you know, gotten me all kinds of neuroimaging and put me on meds and who knows what. So luckily he didn't do that. But that's what his training would have inspired him to do. And so my colleagues in medicine and clinical practice did not go into this to be ignorant and harmful. They went into this to know things and help people. And we want to work with the international research group that we now are to give them information such that they can be much more skillful and helpful and add value to the adventure of what we call emergent phenomenology and most people would call spiritual, mystical, magical, et cetera. So that's hopefully it gives something of my background. And I'm 54 at the moment, so.
Thank you very much for that. Yeah, I know you do a lot of podcasts. I'm sure you get asked that every time. So,
but it's useful if if you haven't heard it. It's a new audience, right? So
of course. And you know, initially I felt drawn to your work, and I've actually realized increasingly the more that I have connected to your work, the more alignment there is on different domains, which is really cool. Particularly, and like recently, a lot of my focus has been, and with articles and podcast guests as well, looking at what you described, the kind of crazy making of certain experiences that we see in the West through misunderstanding, not quite having a particular worldview or way to encapsulate these experiences. And that's maybe something to touch upon at some point through that. And you note the kind of these two Daniels and what can feel like a separation between like the path of awakening and then the more therapeutic and psychological approach. And I guess that's what I'd like for us to explore. Cause I know in your book, you do mention putting the value of almost putting a line between the two and the misconception that awakening, go on, interrupt.
So yes, there's both value in putting a line between the two as separate endeavors in certain very specific practice contexts and very specific ways of framing this. And from other points of view, do I think the process of awakening has numerous very important implications for, you know, a process of awakening, as Daniel 1 would call it. Daniel 2 has no idea what to call that, right? The Dr. Daniel wasn't trained in anything like that. But what Daniel 1 would call awakening, that process has numerous extremely important implications for mental health, for resilience, for some of the challenges that can occur along that path, with things coming up in very complicated ways, deep shifts in existential relationships to oneself, to death, to life, to experience, to the sense of control. These are all extremely important topics that can have many various mental health implications, including, you know, is this world real? Is there actually a past and a future? Do I actually exist?
Yeah.
These are, or in what way? These are very important topics that can come up on this journey. And then the clinical world has a very, very limited, what I would, you know, consider a primitive understanding of those, very nascent, early, naive, simplistic, not always very helpful understanding of this whole process, its highs, its lows, its weirds, its potential for incredible transformations of consciousness and the relationship to all of experience, including pain and emotions and grief and suffering and joy and all of that, as well as the challenges, right? So the challenges that can arise on that path. So getting the clinical world a much more sophisticated understanding of that whole range is the goal of the EPRC.
Yeah, thanks for that clarification as well. I think maybe a more accurate way of describing it is that it's not always a replacement for certain approaches that like Western psychology have actually done well at, even though they don't cover the territory of awakening so well. There are
areas.
Oh,
that's definitely true.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of contributions. Like everyone's like, oh, Eastern psychology is so much better than Western psychology. Mm-hmm. Western psychology has done some fantastic things.
Yeah.
The personality disorders, you just don't find them in Eastern stuff and our important stuff. Attachment theory.
Yeah.
You don't find that in the Eastern stuff in the same kind of way. It's really, really important. In fact, like the vast majority of trouble and complexity and stuff people get into teachers with and traditions, I think is mostly attachment theory explaining and relating to that very, very well.
Yeah.
So the personality disorders are like, it's this glaring shadow side of the Eastern traditions that they think, oh, meditation will solve them. Well, they didn't even know they existed, but assuming they knew they existed, that when they run into them, they think, oh, meditation will solve them. I'm not sure that's true, actually. So that's another thing. It might be it help in some ways, might make it worse in others.
Mm.
It's really a complicated topic. And so there's that, and there's more, like, you know, internal family systems, I think is really cool. CBT, like everyone's like, oh, that's just Buddhism reframed. Actually, it's more sophisticated than that. Like, it's not just, you know, rehashing of some Buddhist mind tricks or something. It's much more than that. And so, and even some of, like, going back to Freud, like Freud gets, you know, sort of like there's stuff in Freud that I think is still valuable. Yeah. Like, sorry if that makes me unpopular with anybody who's a truly anti-Freudian, not that he didn't have tremendous problems. I get it. But like there's cool stuff in there.
Yeah.
And Jung, like, is a rephrasing or a bringing forward of archetypal concepts in a way that sort of works better, I think, with some Western cultural stuff and the myths and all of that. Joseph Campbell, for example, another one. You know, I know you've done some stuff with Joseph Campbell. Those are valuable contributions. And so I while there's a tremendous amount that's the Eastern and even Western mystical traditions, such as the Catholic mystics, et cetera, and Kabbalistic mystics and Sufis and stuff can add to the clinical debates. The clinical side has also done incredibly useful work that you don't really find in the same way over here. So that we think that cross-pollination is going to have a lot of capacity, or even like transactional analysis, which has kind of gone out of favor and still has all kinds of useful tech in it. It's actually very good stuff. So,
yeah, I fully agree with that. And there's like and I know you synthesize from a lot of different inspirations as well. And I know there's that kind of defined pathway of Buddhism, but you do draw upon a lot of different influences. I'm the same. I get so much value from, you know, the people that you mentioned, more Jung than Freud, but I can see that Freud has some really relevant insight. And I think it is as well, part of the wisdom is like discerning, well, where is this practice relevant? Where is it not so relevant? And the reason that I like the topic today that we're discussing is because I found that the experiential journey of meditation and you know, and concentration and mindfulness doesn't really satisfy the part of me that wants to go into the more mythological realms or actually live a meaningful life. And to, it's almost, maybe this is an oversimplification, but it's almost like there's a mechanical microscopic potential with meditation and concentration that has profound insight and realization that can cause the shifts that you mentioned. And at the same time, there's more of like a macro level, like just living life, living a meaningful life, relationships, inwardly, those dimensions of imagination and all those different realms. So I think that synthesis is crucial. You did mention, and it's really important, I want to go back to it as well, the idea of like a, you know, a personality disorder, or whatever it may be, like some kind of psychological distortion, trauma that's unresolved, and the link with awakening. And this is something that I do see frequently, that there's a conflation between, and you did touch upon this, awakening equals like illumination, no shadow, full healing. And it's dangerous territory, I suspect, to assume that. What would your view on that be in terms of the relationship between those two?
Yeah, so just straight out of the gate, I'm going to annoy some people here. Presuming that awakening will eliminate the shadow, I consider incredibly dangerous thinking. I don't know. I personally have never met anyone for whom I think this is true. And while my friend circle certainly does not include anything like all awakened beings, or not even close, it does include a lot of them. And you get to see the backroom politics, the petty stuff, the life challenges, mm-hmm. the, you know, how they interact with their family and what happens when they have a major, you know, life setback. And you get to see that we all have shadows. We all have challenges. We all have our blind spots, every one of us. Mm-hmm. I don't know anybody that's fully gotten over their attachment style stuff. I don't know anybody who's fully cured their personality disorder things or traits, you know, because when stressed, we all have whatever traits we have. And I don't know anybody who has a perfect set of coping skills. I don't know anybody who has it all figured out. I don't know if these people exist, I haven't met them. Mm-hmm. And it's very easy when people show up on a podcast, or they're always up on the front cushion and they're always speaking at their, you know, in their particular mode of confidence with that mm-hmm. kind of presentation-y sort of style. Great. But you actually get to live with people and you get to see the day-to-day of it, you know, in community, or get to, you know, watch your friend circle who has incredible depth of practice go through the things that life can throw at you, and recognize we're all still human in this, and failing to recognize that humanity and overhyping what awakening and deep meditative and related attainments can do. Like, I have a lot of people who have very high perfection models, psychological perfection of action, of speech, of mm-hmm. energetic systems, mm-hmm. of shadow. I don't believe any of those models. Mm-hmm. Not that there can't be a lot of good done, and a lot of progress, and a lot of healing, and a lot of integration, and a lot of illumination. All of those things are definitely possible. But the notion that it's going to happen 100% in any of those cases, I personally don't believe. That doesn't mean it couldn't be true. It could be my limited data set or limited ability to perceive these things. I recognize the quality of evidence, but that's my current impression. And I think that not only is that really important to understand to manage expectations, but it's super important from a practice point of view, mm-hmm. because otherwise people on the path can develop these incredible shadow sides as by pursuing an ideal of perfection, they then push down the sides of themselves that don't meet with their ideal of perfection. And I've seen that in myself and every single one of my colleagues more times than I can count, because the spiritual marketplace is so full of perfection models. They're just everywhere in nearly every tradition, the sense of exalted sainthood, or, you know, pick your favorite ideal of what this will lead to, that all of us have these internalized in some way that even if we intellectually say, oh yeah, I don't actually intellectually believe that, at some emotional level, they've gotten in.
Mm.
They've gotten into all of us. And we have to wrestle with that. And yet again, notice, oh, I just bought into a subtle subconscious, barely perceived, you know, perfection trip there.
Mm.
And wake up to the realities of ordinary humanity.
Yeah.
And it also, the other problem is if you're on the path of acceptance, right? Where mm-hmm. accepting reality is an important part of waking up to it. It's very hard to accept a reality, sorry, to wake up to a reality that you don't accept.
Yeah.
And so these models make it harder to accept this reality, and thus I think harder to wake up. Not that they can't be very inspiring also. So they're a double-edged sword, right?
Yeah.
They can inspire people. Oh, I might, you know, become perfect in whatever way.
Yeah.
And that can galvanize energy and make people practice and call to them in that sort of mythic resonance way of like an archetypal being. There's a perfect being, right? The archetype of perfection. And so from a Jungian point of view, right?
Yeah.
You know, chasing that perfection archetype might rouse in the way that myths and stories do tremendous energy to practice.
Mm. So
that's valuable, but it's also incredibly dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
So there are things you gain and lose from perfection models, and there's no perfect answer to that, because models of perfection do inspire people to do great, amazing things and to be better.
Yeah.
Okay, true.
Yeah, it's almost like that. To allow it to, because again, like there's this notion of striving being a bad thing in spirituality, but I actually think that striving to know you will very, very unlikely ever meet perfection, but to strive to do better, to meet that image, the inner sage archetype, like to do what you can to live that whilst having a realistic view of how frequently you fail to live up to it, whilst not guilting yourself for not living up to it and kind of using it as a North Star rather than like forming an image of the self around that yeah, as you touch upon, can, you know, lead. Yeah, the example that comes to mind for me is emotional perfectionism. Like I remember when I first started practicing mindfulness, I had no idea that I'd created a conceptual idea of what it means to be mindful. So feelings, you know, if I was impatient, I'd be suppressing like those emotions related to any, basically this image of mindfulness, anything outside of that, I just was unconsciously denying. And I imagine it's the same as well, like with the kind of guru complex, and we can all tap into that territory. If you start to believe you don't have a shadow, surely that's going to create a much bigger shadow than if you're like, I probably do. It's not so evident right now.
Or I definitely do.
Or I definitely do. Yeah. One. Yeah. Yeah. And it's just a matter of what context. Because I know for me, you know, it's in relationship. That's where I see myself in the most unfavorable light by you know, a long stretch. And then it can be hard to reconcile. And like for me personally, I've struggled to, I think, to reconcile what comes up in like my most intimate relationship and how reactive I can be compared to, I feel like I'm doing pretty well with meditation and I feel like I'm making progress. It's like, okay, how do you reconcile those?
Well, in the same way, so the example I use of meditation and relationships, so imagine that you had the ideal that all authors would be great pianists and all pianists would of course be great authors. What? So both authors and pianists spend a tremendous amount of time typing on keys in precise and specific sequences according to a logic and a grammar of their particular style and thematic thing, composing pieces to move people in an emotional way, emotionally and even intellectually, if they're studying the theory of their music, you know, with incredible coordination for many, many hours a day. These seem, from a certain point of view, almost identical skill sets. And so, of course, you would expect all authors to be great concert pianists and all great concert pianists to be great authors. because it's nearly the same thing to sit hitting keys all day in a specific sequence to move people according to a specific grammatical and theoretical structures, right? And yet, of course, all authors are not great pianists and all great pianists are not great authors. In fact, you find almost nobody who is both that I know of. And yet, okay, so take that example where it seems like you're practicing an incredibly similar skill set. Okay, so all people who sit silently on cushions, looking precisely at their internal experience with equanimity and, you know, striving for mental silence, are going to necessarily be good at speaking with other people in a relational way that is, you know, focused on somebody's, you know, a theory of mind about them and listening to them and forming words and phrases in a skillful way. Do those seem like the same skill sets? Does that seem like the same kind of practice? Mm-hmm. Why would you assume that practicing this thing would necessarily translate to that thing, which just seems actually quite different from, and in fact, in some ways, even the opposite of, right? Being quiet and still versus speaking, looking inward versus looking outward, relating to someone else in a way that has to build concepts versus deconstructing concepts in your theories of self. Mm-hmm. Like these are almost antithetical skill sets. And yet we presume that, of course, if I learn meditation, this will help my relationships. And do we presume when I learn relationships, it will necessarily help my meditation? Why does it not go the other way necessarily? Maybe I think it does actually, potentially, but like, so this is very weird kind of magical thinking to presume that the one training will necessarily impact the other. Consequently, I think we should work on multiple fronts.
Yeah, I agree. And it goes back to that, what we were discussing around Western psychology and attachment styles and attachment theory and learning these different tracks of development simultaneously. At the same time, I'm sure we both experientially, you know, you probably more than myself, the benefit of meditation, concentration, mindfulness, and just generally improved self-awareness as almost like a foundational practice that does have crossover in terms of, I guess I'd be intrigued to know how you view that in terms of, I feel more centered and more present, how that enhances life, relationships, and the kind of mental health benefits.
Well, in the same way that the act of typing all day probably makes it easier to learn how to play the piano because you've already got all the muscle coordination, in the same way that learning to pay attention to your inner world might make it easier to pay attention to what someone is saying to you. In the same way that if you learn to be peaceful here, you might be able to learn to be peaceful and equanimous in relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, sure. So it's not like there aren't some specific aspects of this that might translate and probably do translate. And I think that's valuable, but presuming you get the whole package, which is usually how the thinking goes, from doing the one to translate entirely to the other, I don't think it's true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's more of a, you'd view it more of an enhancement of these other tracks.
There are aspects of each that translate to the other.
Yeah.
Good listening to other people might make it easier to listen inwardly to yourself.
Yeah.
Sure.
So this kind of leads into this balance of self-realization and meaning. I wonder if we could begin by defining self-realization, because I know it's not an end point, but more of an apex of development. So maybe if we explore self-realization and insight and then bridge into meaning, the reason that came to mind now is because of, in my experience, the more equanimity I have, the more I've been able to engage with like meaningful content or imagery. I wonder if we could begin by looking at the self-realization path and then move into meaning. Around that.
Sure. So the first thing is actually, as soon as you use the term self-realization, you alienate all the no-self people, as well as probably the Abrahamic traditions, as well as everybody. That's a phrase that comes out of a mix of psychology and Vedanta. So just recognize that if you're coming from a background that is something other than, you know, self-actualization in the psychological sense or Vedanta, you know, realizing the true self, then actually what I'm going to say actually I think should apply to you as you know, more broadly, and then that very specific linguistic phrasing would necessarily imply. So actually the way I would talk about this is if you consider the world of experience and the world of meaning, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And initially I'm going to consider them as separate things, and then I'm going to kind of put them back together. So the world of experience, this is just your ordinary straightforward experiences, sights, sounds, touch, space, proprioception, smells, all you know, all that. Very literally right now, you're seeing this, you're listening to this, just in a very straightforward, not woo-woo kind of way. Where this gets interesting, we can all probably agree the things we're seeing are occurring now. I think we can agree on that. If we're hearing something now, it is occurring now.
Mm-hmm.
That we can agree on. If we are feeling something now, it is occurring now. Okay, fine. Where it gets interesting is thoughts. When a thought occurs now, it might have the meaning over here of past. And even though the experience of a thought of past occurs now, most people miss that as an experience and instead focus entirely and purely and operationally and functionally, and it might be very useful to do so, on the meaning of past or the meaning of future.
Mm-hmm.
So thought, all of which occurs now, has this fascinating ability through meaning to construct the sense of time. Now, obviously, questions of time and is time real and is it a construct and all that are very, we could go down a long rabbit hole with that, but just kind of roll with me, regardless of more complicated debates. Clearly, thoughts of past that occur now have a meaning that implies not now. And thus, thoughts of a self that is permanent occur in a transient way.
Mm-hmm.
So you can have a thought that arises whose meaning is, I am permanent. But the experience of that is utterly ephemeral, transient, and very small and subtle in terms of actually what you experience. And so in the realm of meaning, you can construct a permanent self that you cannot find in experience. You can construct a past and a future that you cannot find in experience other than thoughts occurring now. You can extract a sense of continuity that you do not find in the discrete transient ephemerality of experience. And you can actually construct a sense of a will from naturally arising sensations. As anybody mm-hmm. who's ever sat on a cushion and attempted to control all of their thoughts or experiences has noticed, good luck with that, right? This is the first insight nearly everybody has when they attempt to meditate. I cannot control this. I cannot make this do what I want it to do. Something deep and fundamental in the sense of agency, right? Mm-hmm. We can imagine I am an agent that is in control of the meaning. Those thoughts arise naturally and causally, right?
Yeah.
And so suddenly we see some of the greatest existential debates that are, you know, being played out now in books like Determined and Questions of Time and Physics Think Time is Real or Necessary to Its Equations, right? Suddenly we're touching on very, very deep things. And even having this conversation, people have very strong reactions to this. No, I really am a controller. I really do exist. My past is a real thing that really exists. And so real is a funny word in this case, because it depends on your epistemic frame. And most people are not very sophisticated, nothing personal against any of you. I don't mean that in a broad global way. I mean this in a very specific, focused way of noticing both simultaneously that thoughts of past and future and self and whatever occur now in this transient, immediate way, and yet their meanings resonate with full emotional impact and import and even predictive and, you know, remembering utility. So the ability to remember, all memories occur now, but we usually take their past component and their meaning as the thing we're operationalizing, ignoring that they're just experiences occurring now. So all projections of future. And so what I would say is that waking up to the experience component as strongly as we are awake to the meaning component. So not to denigrate or dismiss the imagination or meaning or the sense of a functional past or future or continuity or time or agency or responsibility or any of that, all of which occurs in the realm of meaning. But we must, like, from my point of view, what this, one of the key tricks to this that really seems to help in a positive way is also waking up to the fact that these experiences are occurring simultaneously as the thing that generates the meaning that opens up the realm of the imaginal time, self, future, progress, you know, ideals, conception, analysis, all of that, right?
Yeah.
And so that's this, now we've set up the interesting thing. And so from my point of view, you can awaken to both. Right, you can awaken to the full realm of what the meanings are and the depths and the implications and the theories and all of that, but you can also wake up to the fact of experience being experience, and that eventually that's automatic, where meaning and experience arise as the complete actual package that they are, right? Not as differentiated things, but as dual aspects of the same thing. And this is where you get into like dual aspect monism, and you know, mind and body splits and all these kinds of things, right? But actually there is an experiential and attentional mode that people can find and train to and or realize, depending on how you want to think about it, and you're, you know, be saved by, that incorporates both equally.
Yeah. That was awesome. I really, that was, you've just articulated something that has been on the kind of periphery of my ability to articulate for a while. And I love the way that you just described that. Something that comes to mind.
It took a long time. That's a long time coming. I've been stumbling around in this territory for, you know, a long time to try to figure out how to do that. So
yeah,
this is not a quick process. But if I made it look easy, it was not easy getting to be able like to
two hands, really job done.
Right. Yeah. It was not easy to go through the process that allowed me to not only realize these things in the way I'm describing, but also be able to describe it. And I'm still working on it, right? There's probably a better way to do it that would reach people better, and you know.
Yeah, and this is a thing, and you know it's not easy, and I think the reason it's not is because it's so paradoxical.
For most, there are some it's easy for, like, but most people it's not. There are a few.
Do you think there's both as well? Like, there are people, or established kind of thought leaders or meaning leaders who articulate both. I don't know of any that are doing it like lucidly. And I think that synthesis, that's probably just because I'm not aware of them. I'd really like to, or maybe that's not accurate, but anyway, that's a tangent. Something that comes to mind with this.
I think they are, like, you know, like, just the quickest example that comes to mind is a person who I think did both sides of this really well is Rob Berbea.
Okay, I'm not familiar with him.
Anyway, yeah. Check out, you know, and the emphasis, so he was a person who could, you know, what he might have conceptualized as emptiness or something. Again, I'm like, the precision of exactly how he would phrase it, I'm not going to be able to duplicate.
Yeah.
But also, and then also the imaginal realm, the realm of meaning, which is incredibly important.
Yeah.
And people, you know, I think a lot of the traditions can emphasize one or the other more strongly. Like shamanic stuff tends to emphasize this side,
yeah,
right? Jungian stuff, psychology tends to emphasize the realm of meaning. And then you get the immediate, like, Vipassana and really moment to moment phenomenological traditions that really emphasize this side. And there are traditions, like, I think, you know, Vajrayana and Mahayana would say, oh, we're really doing both. We're doing a lot of this side and really exploring the specifics of your imaginal and archetypal and past and futures and karma and all this stuff. And we're also, you know, pointing directly to the emptiness or fullness or shunyata or rigpa or whatever, you know, Mahamudra, Dzogchen, as they would call it. So I think there are traditions, but do they phrase it in this kind of particular way that I did, kind of putting both together? Like, yes, sort of, but, like, you know, which phrasing is going to work best for you or anybody is going to be highly variable.
Yeah.
And so if my phrasing doesn't work for people, you know, there are plenty of other traditions that talk about this.
Yeah.
And if it does work, well, great. Glad you got it right this time.
Yeah, I think I want to retract my statement, because I know people, like, you've just articulated it so clearly. And I had a guest on the show, Leanne Whitney, who's created a synthesis of Jung and Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, which is really cool. And also my friend Nick as well. We have a lot of discussions around this area. Where I wanted to go with that was like the realization of this kind of dual aspect, based around the idea of like the now. Because I know like the popularity of like Eckhart Tolle and a lot of these
mm-hmm. absolutely
these teachings, it's like only the now exists.
Adi Ashanti, right? There's a bunch of these.
It's a really powerful, present, relevant exploration. And I used to be of that, like when I first got into meditation. Oh yeah, of course, like only the now exists. And then I think it becomes, but what is now? Because, and you mentioned this, the idea of synchronicity by default is outside of space and time. Moments that seem to have linearity can be joined from past, future, present in a way that really challenges the notion. Do you know what I mean? Where I'm pointing to with that,
well,
the idea
that's
of,
that's a whole nother. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Like, and for me, that I bring that up because of the insight around, well, if it's only ever present, how could it be that there seems to be some kind of a causal link of events that spiral, that reflect, come back, return, whatever. And it does pose those questions or experientially to have that, I don't know which hand's which, but like the hand of meaning that kind of like joins out along this experience of the now. I don't know how you want to riff off that, but
yeah, so that is actually a super good question and thing to talk about that people rarely ask about it. So A plus.
My need for validation is complete.
Well, like it's honest, like it's a brilliant one. So if you look at the literature on magic or psi as routinely described and discussed, there is plenty of evidence, regardless of whether or not you like that type of evidence or the conclusions mm-hmm. that one might draw from it, that not only time, but also space is nothing like the way we think it is. So if you look at the literature on remote viewing, for example, like space is clearly not quite like what we think it is. Mm-hmm. And how in the world can some of these people do these things? The literature on prognostication, the literature on children remembering past lives from people that they never possibly met and they're three, and mm-hmm. this other person died 10 years ago and there's no way they could read or find, you know, like there. So if you look at that, like you know, the work of DOPS with regard to all these kids reporting past lives and things, if you look at the work of Lynn McTaggart, for example, and stuff about retrocausal prayer impacts and fascinating things like that,
yeah.
as well as the whole literature on synchronicities, that is totally fascinating stuff. You know, Bernie Beitman stuff, you should check out his podcast and his work and his book. There are so many of these examples that defy anything related to linear time and seem to hint at underlying structures that are way more complicated. And then you can get into your whole question of what sort of ontological frames best work for you in the face of the possibilities of nonlinear time or you know, beyond local causality or superluminal communication, or you can get into all these fascinating topics. Now, I myself am a strict ontologically agnostic empirical pragmatist, mm-hmm. meaning that I pragmatically look at what in my personal experience, reproducibly, second meaning of the word empirical, so empirical in the David Humean sense and the like scientific experiment sense.
Mm-hmm.
So practically in my experience, reproducibly lends value, and like different frames lend value in different situations. And there are frames for which linear time is a super useful assumption, certain physics problems most of our lives, and things about banking and when do we need to do our taxes and all of that stuff, and what's on my calendar next Tuesday, linear time, and how long will it take to do this flight to occur. Linear time is a super useful concept. And then there are situations, not many of them, but they definitely exist, where nonlinear time is, you know, circular time, recursive time, fifth dimensional time, if you want to like add the possibility of like warps in the fourth dimension to whatever, I don't know, like pick your favorite, you know, complicated ontologies here, that might have more explanatory or practical value for solving certain problems or relating to certain experiences or fitting certain data sets. And again, I'm not going to come down on any of those being true or not true. I'm very much more on the side of what is useful to you for dealing with what you're dealing with.
Yeah.
But yes, great thing to raise. What are your thoughts on this?
I agree with what you're saying. Like to look at value, for me, my kind of awakening did align, and like starting mental health crisis, awakening, meditation, they were very close together. I turned to meditation to help with the mental health, and that led to an awakening. And the word that I use a lot is enchantment. And synchronicity for me has added a value to my experience, a poetry to my experience, that I cannot comprehend, and I have to surrender to what is outside of my consciousness whilst acknowledging that what is outside of my consciousness is meaningful, is directive in a, not necessarily in a logical way, but in an artistic way that has allowed for me to, in addition to meditation and the kind of awareness side of it, has allowed me to navigate life in a completely different way that has made suffering more bearable. That, like for me, on it, like for me, the, one of the biggest shifts was the idea of learning is completely different to how, when I was in school, and this idea of reading and education. Post whatever happened in my experience, everything that I've learned when it's been aligned and meaningful has been synchronistic. There's no way I could have digested what I have in the time that I have, but it's like our conversations, things that I read in your book this morning, things that you're talking about now, they tend to gravitate around or orbit around some sense of meaning, even though I don't necessarily know what that is explicitly. So for me, it has been, it's been a shift in, I guess, the life path aspect of it, whereas awareness has been creating a fundamental change in how I relate to emotions, to thoughts, to experience. So I think just nice, the poetry of it is... for me, I find so much value in that.
Yes, the re-enchantment of life, the marveling, the wonder, the sense of awe and amazement that can arise from synchronicities. I'm sorry about the background noise, by the way. There's construction happening across the street from my Airbnb. I don't know if you can hear it or if doing a good job.
All good. I didn't hear it.
Doing a good job of filtering it out. There's a very large construction going on. But the re-enchantment of life, the amazement, the sense of being supported in some seemingly magical way, the sense of things unfolding in a way that seems beyond what one could have anticipated or expected, almost like the universe has an intelligence and is caring for you, and that the story is unfolding as if it's being written by someone who has a sense of how to tell a story. All of those kinds of sentiments could be very transformational from a psychological point of view and level. I'm not, again, advocating or saying that any of those ontologies are necessarily absolutely true, but the arising of those sorts of feelings and impressions and interpretations itself can certainly be incredibly transformational.
Yeah. something that I do think is important is that the practice of concentration, and however you might define it, that like clearing the mind, so to speak, in my experience, has allowed for a clearer comprehension of what is genuinely synchronistic and outside of conscious control, compared to my conscious mind trying to join dots or my own projections. And I think there's something there in the relationship between the two. They kind of enhance each other in a way, I think, or at least more spaciousness around phenomena allows for a more full embodied flourishing of that synchronistic experience or symbolic or mythological without getting lost there. Cause that's a risk as well, getting lost in that terrain and disconnecting from the real world, so to speak.
Well, defining obviously is the air quotes there around real world is important thing, but your warning is also very true. So it is definitely true that I've talked with a lot of people and even had occasional moments myself where the sense of appreciation of synchronicity and underlying meanings can get out of control, can be problematic, can go in either the direction of, oh my golly, I am this amazing wizard that is navigating secret magical pathways through the divine love universe in some way that everything I do is blessed and all of this is, you know, like, or something, right? You can go the super positive way. And then equally, there's the really negative way that like, ooh, that subtle weird thing that happened does mean that there are, you know, sinister energies out to get me, and that like I am a cursed being and my path is, because there are negative synchronicities as well, like somebody, you know, like a whole series of bad things happen to you all in a way that seemed to hit at like exactly the worst moments, and exactly your worst things that could have happened, and like the exact worst thing you could have responded or said. And that, like, so synchronicities can be both very cool and like, oh my golly, my path is unfolding in this way that just seems like all the right books are showing up and the right teachers and people and conversations. And also it can go the other way, and that can make people really paranoid and super weird in that direction, or sometimes some very confused mix of both.
Yeah,
like, oh, I connected with the good people and we fought the evil forces, and like it can, you know, and that from a certain point of view, like from a Jungian point of view, that archetypal journey and way of perceiving reality through that kind of magical lens can, even when it has its negative, shadowy, dark, sinister components to it, you know, Jung would obviously enfold all of that as something that you could do something really cool with.
Did you see the shadow then?
I did, actually. That was eerie.
As you were talking about the shadowy, yeah, sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, you noticed, I saw that too, yeah.
That's pretty mental.
Anyway, that was pretty weird when my camera just decided somehow to shift the lighting for unknown reasons. Right. Yeah, that was, so that's the eerie, right? So there's a synchronicity, and then do you take that to be an actual shadow? Is that a sinister thing? Or is that like just like the universe magically reflecting what I happen to be talking about as a point of helpful emphasis? Or just to make it ooh and spicy and interesting to enhance the conversation, so we have something immediate that seems really cool to talk about. Like, what is that? And there's a lot of different ways you could interpret that, you know, or was that a sinister being, you know, that I had invoked, you know, from some sort of waving my hand and casting a spell to invoke a shadow. And now there's a shadow haunting us and this conversation will be cursed. Like there's so many places you could go with this. And depending, so that's that empirical pragmatist point of view, like I could adopt any or all of those intelligences, and I get to see the experiment of when I interpret that thing, which you could see, right? That was a physical end of my camera and or the lighting in the room doing something, right? And yet the interpretations might have radically different potential outcomes.
Yeah.
And so from a point of view of the illusion of choice, which I do still think is an illusion, just sorry for anybody who doesn't, but like from the illusion of choice, you know, sort of ordinary point of view, like which we choose might make a real difference in our lives. And so to have that meta capacity to notice when we're choosing an ontology and to go, is that the best ontology for this situation? Or to notice when we've made a series of choices of ontologies yes. that are explanatory in a meaning level way and go, how did that work out? So we can gain some wisdom from noticing patterns of when we choose certain ontologies in certain situations. Maybe we see have what we think are better or worse outcomes. And to have some meta capacity around that, I think is a really important thing to develop mm-hmm. Just as a human being, but also on the path, if you want to be formal about like the meditative or spiritual path
yeah.
or the psychological path for that matter, assuming there's a division.
So what this makes me think of is, and as my, and to honor this, not making kind of, not drawing conclusions, my sense is that synchronicity is inherently meaningful, and the risk of interpretation is the light again. Did you see it just went again? The risk of interpretation is what can draw those different conclusions, and meditation, and particularly for me, I think of equanimity as just hold, like don't jump in to frame some kind of dogma around these experiences, but be equanimous what actually happened. There was, because I've had a lot of profound synchronicities that I know I could have just completely lost my shit and actually went into that territory of losing my shit. And then I was like, just be equanimous. And actually for me, prioritizing equanimity, I think I was just really fortunate in connecting to, like, one book was Yogananda's autobiography of a yogi, and the emphasis there of like what the actual practice is, and warning of cities and powers. And I don't know why I just really like clung to that, because I was having a lot of ups and downs. You mentioned the ups, downs, and weirds and plateaus, and I just felt like, if I really attach to these experiences, then it's going to cause suffering in some way. And it did for me with some highs. The when I first experienced enchantment and then it went, that for me was, I never knew it was possible to experience and perceive in that way with such lucidity. And I was convinced I was enlightened and that it was going to stick. So when that dulled, I felt profound grief, actually.
And there are a lot of maps. Again, people don't necessarily like the maps, but that is predicted in a lot of the maps,
mm-hmm.
that there will be an initial high and opening to the magical, the vibrational, the energetic, the archetypal, the insight, the you know, profound states of mind that might be blissful or profoundly equanimous or expansive or very creative or mm-hmm. very sort of manic appearing from a Western medicine point of view, hypomanic manic. And you know, that there might be a crash after those. Not that everybody has a crash, but as the hero's journey, there's the first like, oh, I am actually the hero. And then, oh, I find myself in the underworld, right?
Yeah.
That kind of theme recurs again and again and again and across a lot of traditions. You find it in the Catholic mystics and the Sufis and the Kabbalists and, you know, Tree of Life and the Buddhist maps and, you know, lots maps from a whole lot of places. Mm-hmm. And our life experiences, right? So mm-hmm. it's not just external theory. You get to live this and see, oh yeah, I notice that pattern too sometimes.
Yeah.
Sometimes that is a pattern that makes some kind of sense. And not only normalizing your experience, but also predicting what might happen next, but also prescribing potential remedies if you're in a tradition that has figured out something about some cool tech or mind maneuvers or practices or whatever you might be able to do to figure out how to navigate those highs, lows, weirds, and plateaus, because mm-hmm. you know, all the well-developed traditions have that
mm-hmm.
built into them
mm-hmm.
From people stumbling around and figuring out stuff that they found useful. And so it can be very useful to have maps around that also, you know, sometimes, but the maps also can be sources of comparison and judgment and competition and all, you know,
yeah,
confusion.
Yeah. And I feel like it's so easy to just like rapidly create a rigid belief system that it takes actually a lot of equanimity not to solidify a map and just to be like, right, try and use this for reference. Same with beliefs and concepts, to actually like hold it as lightly as possible rather than oh, I'm here, so that means that's where I'm going and that's where I was. But actually, the I guess the fundamental fluidity of ideally what useful categories are, or useful concepts, or useful maps, that they are not, they're a best interpretation at the time. They're bound to be things that stand that test of time, but they have to be open to not completely disintegrate, but to be challenged and to update in relevant ways. And I guess that something that we've touched upon here is like, well, even a lot of these profound Eastern traditions, there are ways that they can be updated and incorporated with insight from the West. And yeah, I think that the liveliness of the intellectual interpretation of spirituality, I think, is something that is a bit of a slippery slope for people, either being rigid or and regurgitating the intellectual, or mistaking the intellectual as not like disembodied. That, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And even within each of the traditions, they go through periods of innovation and expansion and dialogue and incorporation, and then contraction and rigidity and solidification of orthodoxy. So even each of the traditions has gone through this, and you get to see these phases. And then you get to see all these factions break off. Some people really liked the innovation and some people really didn't. And then traditions split and then may recombine and do all these funny things. So it's a very organic process, and it's an ongoing dialogue. And it's easy for us to sometimes look back at the past with this sort of archetype of perfection, or archetype of they figured it out, or archetype of, wow, this is the perfect system because it showed me this cool thing that worked really well for me, and then the rest must be true. And in the same way, we can also go through these personal phases of all these systems suck and none of them really describe my practice, and all of that. So I think gaining some appreciation of all of these oscillations relate to dogma and orthodoxy and innovation, as well as like prefacing meaning or prefacing bare experience. Like, it's very natural for us to oscillate between these things, even if our intellect, the conservative parts of our intellect, may wish us to sort of hold one for a while, which never actually works. But and we can have, like, from an internal family systems point of view, we have within ourselves the ones that want to know the answer and want the stability and want the certainty. And we also have the parts of ourselves that want to explore and want to be creative and want to find new things and want that freshness and aliveness.
Yeah.
And to recognize that the vast majority of the debates within traditions are aggregates of people who one or the other of these voices was stronger that day or week or month or year or decade or century or millennia.
Yeah.
And you know, they congregated around that primacy of those inner voices, even though we all have all these parts within us.
It's making me think as well of like the opposite. And you could say that it is some play of like the magician archetype, the shadow of the magician archetype, which is like a willing, either through neglect or willingly descending into chaos as a justification of this somehow being like spiritual. For example, just here are structures that society agree upon, be it the way that we relate, be it the way we define boundaries, whatever it may be. And then that shadow side of, oh, concepts, they're just an illusion. Who needs concepts? And then it just becomes this like mud, this soup of fragmented, nonsensical experience. And that's something that I've seen
play out. Postmodernism.
There you go. I've just described unintentionally postmodernism. I wonder what your thoughts are on that and how it relates also to spiritual practices, and also probably teacher student dynamics as well.
Wow, let's do that in 5 minutes. No,
give it 10.
obviously, Right? That's a tremendous amount of that could be, you know, we could talk for hours and hours and hours about that.
Yeah.
So it is true that there are traditions that have very reasonably pushed back against the rigid orthodoxies and deconstructed them and said, you know, that all meaning is constructed, or that, you know, and you find that within various debates and systems and philosophical systems going back for millennia. It's not just a postmodern thing. It's a recurrent topic in philosophy as one of the many poles and extremes. And that's a normal thing to occur as part of the debate and to arise. And the notion of the dark side of wizardry, of chaos, of maybe wanting to like burn the whole system down to bring in the new age, the accelerationists, which you can see as the dark wizards of politics, you know, who want to, you know, who might see things that are wrong with the system and want to break the whole thing and you know, bring in the new visionary magical system that they have created that will be the magical solution. So that's also one of the dark sides of wizardry you get to see out playing out in contemporary politics. I'm not going to name names, but you know, most people will suddenly have a sense of who I'm referencing there by some of the terms I've used. And you know, that's a thing, and that's part of the archetypal mix, and always has been the dark knight archetype that that, you know, rides in and creates chaos, but eventually somehow there's learning that happens, or something that needed to occur that the paladins of the light or something couldn't pull off because they were bought into the system or something, or too limited. So there are all these archetypal things, speaking from those kinds of points of view. The ability to simultaneously appreciate what is useful about deconstructionism and deconstructing terms and concepts and fixed rigidities and recognizing the relative points and positions. There's tremendous power in that for seeing through fixed systems and for shifting things. It's a necessary part of the architecture of how change happens, in the same way that termites, you know, deconstruct a tree and turn it back into hummus that the rest of the forest can use to rebuild new trees and other plants and stuff.
Yeah.
Right. And it goes around in the cycle. So that capacity is a vital one. The vultures that pick at the corpse and, you know, move forward the cycle, that can, like, that's an incredibly vital part of ecosystems. But when we become utterly fascinated with just being termites or vultures, you know, not that that isn't a role that some might find themselves in for a long period of time, just recognizing it's one part of an ecosystem. And there also needs to be the growth and construction and stability and appreciation and other cycles within an ecosystem, intellectual, spiritual, personal, psychological, you know, in the same way that Vipassana might tear down the sense of a self. And you also need something that is building a sense of a skillful self and a meaning, continuity, ordinary, etc. Sense, and you can go too hard on either of those. And so I think, again, that flow between these of the natural energies of creation and destruction, of Shiva and Shakti, or, you know, Brahma or whatever, and like these, you know, this gets pointed to in so many different traditions, sin and redemption, where we learn something through our mistakes.
There's so much there, because you touch upon how this relates to the self, which I think I'll come back to in a second, because, and I don't know if I'm now getting too philosophical. It's not coming from a philosophical place, but.
Well, philosophy can be very pragmatic for some people and can ring in a skillful way with people. So it's not like, and philosophy back in the day, the Greeks expected philosophy to improve your life, right? That's true. Why the Stoics are considered philosophers, even though they sort of look like CBT from a certain point of view, you know?
Yeah. And I guess the conflation with philosophy and science and how that there was less of a distinction between those fields. And what it brings to mind is, because we spoke about meaning and I shared at least my view on it as being inherent. And then we kind of come to the realm of our certain what we deem, and like Plato's theory of form, this idea of maybe there are inherent structures that we believe we've constructed a concept, but actually we've revealed a concept that's coming from a higher form of intelligence or from the collective mind. And at least my experience of this, like when I inwardly as a practice of self-inquiry, I've noticed that when that lens or laser of awareness is there, some things do fall away quite easily, but things do remain as well. And at least for me, that has been my process of discerning truth. And sometimes there's a spell of chaos in that. Sometimes there's this Michelangelo idea of chiseling away at the marble and revealing what is inside. But there does seem to be, through that discernment of awareness, that there's a stability to truth, at least in my experience. And perhaps conceptually, there's also that realm of what we might call the ethical or the moral. Like, have humans created that? Or is there actually an inherent sense of what it means to be ethical, what it means to be kind?
And adopting either of those frames, that morality is totally arbitrary and or self-serving, or morality is intrinsic to the compassionate structure of karma and the universe, you get different things when you adopt each of those, right? Mm-hmm. And so from that, hello.
Morality.
What's happening. So there are shadow sides to both of those, and there are opportunities in both of those. Mm-hmm. So noticing how, when you adopt one of these or the other, things might work out for you or not. I remember I was in a particularly existential phase in college. My romantic poetry professor and complained about, how sort of stark and meaningless my appreciations of the arbitrary nature of the sign, meaning that any word or term or concept seemed to be an arbitrary thing and could be applied anyway, and that it was all, just, and he just smiled and winked at me and said, "Think of the possibilities," and then walked away. And I was like, wow, right? That in the arbitrary nature of everything is the potential to create all kinds of things. And that's the fascinating thing about the intellect, is its tremendous creative potential and ability to vision and envision and then manifest so many amazing things, as we have done, and also so many terrible things, as we have done. So,
yeah. And that innate kind of aspect of the mind, which can be profoundly creative, but is also seems to be the genesis of the self-image, the ego structure, the story of the life that can be confused for life itself when given a free rein to just operate in it by its own, or at least to be believed.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think some of the problems can come when we create something in a way that is very arbitrary or creative, and then we sort of forget that we were the creator of it and buy it as if it's now the default thing, and that's just the way things are.
Mm-hmm.
So our intellectual structures, we can become very enamored of them and forget that we, created them in a creative way.
Yeah.
Like anything.
Yeah.
Or that somebody else did, right? Mm-hmm. That someone else just came up with this stuff and wrote this stuff down, and because it happened to be written down 2,000 years ago or something, oh, now this is the ancient holy thing.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean that there might not be wisdom and value in it. Like, I don't mean to disparage ancient writings. I love them and have gotten tremendous benefit from them and their techniques and perspectives and wisdom. But
yeah,
the veneer of ancientness lending a sense of forgetting that they were just people like us in exactly the same way, just trying to figure this out and writing stuff down and podcasting or writing on clay tablets or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. I've experienced that. Because I mentioned enchantment, and I always feel weird talking about it when I'm feeling particularly disenchanted, because it feels like there's this relic of my past that was so, and it can have it with creativity as well. Like, it, depending on where I'm at, those ideas clearly have a different energy to them. And I think a lot of writers would have experienced being profoundly inspired, writing something down, and then returning to it and being like, what was that? That is not what I remember writing. It's lost all of its almost like there is behind language, behind symbol, there's actually an energy that is potentially transferred in ways that we don't necessarily understand. And it can become stale as well. I think that's it. It's either alive and it remains alive, or it can become stale and dogmatic. And the discernment and intuition of understanding that is part of the path as well.
Yeah, I remember a cartoon I saw, someone else drew this, and I'm going to do my best to describe it from memory, but it was this pendulum swinging. And, you know, if you've got sort of like normal, and then like, as it swings this way, like enchantment and insanity, and then like boring functionality and depression, like, and
sounds about right.
Right. And this is her life swinging back and forth between these.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, for me at least, is the great call for equanimity of wherever that pendulum swing is, try to not get too attached to what is experienced.
Although there are certain things that it's only by buying in, like a flow state is absolute attachment and being like, flow states are this fascinating one.
Yeah.
Because in a flow state, there's not spaciousness and meta perspective. And yet there's a sense of natural equanimity in the task completing itself. That's a, like, there are these funny, very funny things that, like, because equanimity is a funny thing.
Yeah.
Right. And it's got a lot of axes to it. It's not just one static thing. So if you consider that equanimity might have aspects necessarily of spaciousness or ease, even in contraction, which flow states are weirdly very contracted, like the whole rest of the world goes away. All other considerations disappear when you're in a flow state. And yet the level of equanimity and creative power might be amazing, even in something that is very narrow and has no metacapacity or very limited metacapacity to notice itself. Mm-hmm. In fact, one of the best ways to blow a flow state is notice you're in a flow state. Right?
Yeah.
Rather than just being in the flow state. And so, like, is equanimity a meta perspective that doesn't cling to things? Is equanimity the sense of what happens in a flow state when one is so totally involved in something that one isn't meta cognizing on it? And yet the creativity is just moving in a very non-judgmental, natural way. Like, so we have to even be careful with concepts like equanimity. And there's more axes. Like, I didn't even touch on all the possibilities. Like, what do we just to have some recognition that we could get rigid about any of those ideas and what they mean.
Thanks. Because,
you know, the richness of human experience is incredibly complicated.
Yeah. I really appreciate you said that, because as you were talking, I was then reflecting on, what do I mean when I say equanimity helps? And you mentioned flow state, and I've had this I mentioned Nick earlier, the conversations we've had where I've been like, okay, I understand non-duality, but I feel the most alive when really immersed in duality and with content, and it all becomes this kind of process where I'm aware that I'm observing something, and I'm even maybe having a commentary on how beautiful everything is. And there's a sense of being both connected and separate. And that, for me, enchantment is in that realm. Same with flow state. So when I say equanimity helps, you're right. It's not that I'm equanimous in an enchanted state. It's that when that state changes and I notice that I start craving the return of it, I then have to be equanimous to be like, let go of it. Let you know, it will come back in its own time. And similar to flow, it's almost like I can set the environment for it, but there's no way that I can just click my fingers and have that kind of experience. So I guess it points to what we touched upon earlier. Different tools apply at different times, and actually knowing when to apply equanimity. Like, you don't really want to apply equanimity in intimate relationships when immersed in, maybe if you're losing, you know, you're becoming reactive, but if you're just in the moment with someone and enjoying that moment, do you want to be like, oh, wait a minute? So it's almost like the wisdom is knowing what tools to apply at what time and having the tools.
And also recognizing that you're not always going to know what the right tool is. Like, that's the other thing.
Yeah.
Like, to imagine that we can always know exactly what the right tool is, I don't think is true.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of these great debates in therapy. Like, on the one hand, you have the people who do like encounter groups and, you know, primal scream therapy and that sort of thing, you know, or rituals designed to evoke very powerful archetypes, or the sort of healing psychological crisis where some therapists, and like till the person really breaks down and starts crying, they're not thinking they're getting very, very deep and getting to the stuff that can actually move through, or letting your body really shake and shudder to release that trauma or something. These kinds of concepts versus I will mindfully observe all of these feelings and thoughts come and go with a sense of calm detachment that doesn't get bought up in any of the stories, right? Not buying any of the stories is not going to allow you to do deep archetypal shamanic journey work or whatever. Like you have to buy the story, you know? And so again, those are both really cool tools to have in the toolbox, but to imagine that in any one situation, we actually know, like, should I cry and scream? And maybe that helps the energy to move through. And then I just feel really better after a good cry. Or should I just mindfully sit detached, observing? And maybe that's how I get, like,
yeah,
you don't know, you know, but, and sort of having a little bit of humility there, because, you know, I wouldn't know necessarily what is best for anybody else or myself, and be certain, who knows what the causality of this is and the possible repercussions of doing either.
It also makes me think as well of the risk of becoming quite mechanical through trying to be mindful, and how that, I feel like more recently I've understood Zen and particularly Adam Watts, but only because I've gone through stages of becoming really mechanical that I could kind of become effortless in a way that wasn't maladaptive. Right. That's a statement. I'm definitely maladaptive a lot of the time, but it's almost like you interrupt automatic processes that are maladaptive or conditioned in a certain way, understand them. You could say, I don't like the term purify, but kind of work on samskaras or you know, the knots in the psyche or trauma, whatever it is, so that natural processes kind of realign. So there's an intuitive sense of what is right in that moment that it's not going to correlate to, oh, this is a spiritual way of handling this situation, or this is a mindful way, but maybe just being deeply instinctive, having examined and excavated enough to know that you're not being run by like maladaptive distortions or trauma or assumptions potentially.
And then recognizing that even necessarily being super instinctive, are all of our instincts right? No.
Exactly.
Like, and are all of our understandings of what the causal stuff will be? So like you mentioned Alan Watts, right? One of the weird ironies of him is he recognized when he got like smashed on vodka and wandered up onto the stage in a drunken haze and mumbled into the microphone that people found what came out of his mouth super profound and transformational. And some non-trivial portion of what you know of Alan Watts, he probably recited when he was absolutely smashed, which, like, I'm not advocating for anybody getting smashed at all.
Yeah.
I think alcohol causes a staggering amount of problems in the world, but just to say that, like, this is a weird thing where you talk about like purification or skillful intuitive choice of like these skillful mechanisms. Oh, it's doing it again. maybe it's something in the way I move my hand.
Is it one of those sense lights, like, you know, where you can kind of,
I don't know, maybe. Yeah,
could be.
I'm new to this Airbnb, so
yeah
just having to deal with the lighting situation as best I can, and I regret not having my full rig with all the controlled lights and controlled lighting and all of that.
Yeah,
this is just the best I can do on the road at the moment with what I have in my suitcase. So yeah, and ideas of tech perfection plague me, by the way. Like, how perfect can I get my microphones and my cameras?
We had that conversation recently.
Yeah, exactly, right? That's a problem, right?
Yeah.
This can be simultaneously really creating amazing content that really has great tech when you can do it, but also having to let it go in situations like this where literally all of the lights of the place are on and it's still weird lighting. It's like half of me is blue and half of me is red and it's doing these weird things that I don't have no idea why it's doing. So like, and just letting it go and going, maybe it will have to be what it is. And maybe this cool sort of noir look reaches people and they like it. I don't know.
It's it's the right ambience that you don't even realize that you needed for this conversation.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
So these ideas of what is perfection and what the causality of that will be, the irony of Alan Watts getting smashed and mumbling into a mic still having a profound and useful impact on you today.
Mm.
Could someone have necessarily predicted that? And we have to have a sort of a Rumsfeldian humility in unknown unknowns.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots we do not know about what our work and our words and the choices we make will do, both beautiful and terrible.
Mm.
So, and yet we continue to create the content we do and all of that.
Yeah.
How it might be misinterpreted or incredibly inspirational, we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And so we should apologize to, hey, if you're out there in the podcast world, you just said something that totally screwed you up. Sorry about that.
Yeah, sorry about this.
And,
sincere apologies for how much we've led you astray on your path through this conversation.
We did not know, honestly. Despite the possible retrocausality of time, my prognosticator is flawed at the moment.
Oh, yeah. I think it, yeah, is a good point that you make, like, as well. Not conflating always the teacher with the teaching. And it does seem that frequently there are people where stuff just moves through them. They're particularly gifted in terms of writing or speaking. And I find that in myself. Like, sometimes if I talk or write, stuff comes through me and I'm like, I could do with that advice. Thanks for that. Like that, I'll take that, you know.
Oh, I go back and read MCTB all the time and like, mm-hmm. Oh, wow, that was a great point. I should remember that one.
Yeah, it's strange, isn't it? I find that, mm-hmm. Where does it come? I mean, this is a whole other conversation. We're almost out of time, but.
The creative muse, right? This has been mentioned in art like this.
Yeah.
Seems beyond us. Like,
yeah.
Something way beyond ourselves can suddenly come through sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've had that experience a lot. We're like, oh my God, I wrote that?
Mm-hmm.
Like, never would have guessed.
And that. That's another thing I found as well, that creative output has really made me question, where is that intelligence coming from? And
where Alf the sacred river ran through caverns measureless to man down to the sunless sea, from Kubla Khan by Coleridge,
mm-hmm.
Right? Talking about the creative process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're at the 90 minute mark.
We are.
I've thoroughly,
and I should go. This has been, yeah, it's been delightful.
Yeah, I've loved this conversation. There are a few points naturally. I mean, there are more than a few points. There are many essays that we didn't cover, but I really appreciate you taking the time. Maybe we can have another conversation at a different point. And I just wanted to thank you for your generosity. I found you to be really generous with your time. I know we've met a few times. You gave me advice on my tech setup, which I will eventually integrate.
That's my own neurosis, or maybe it's just creatively helpful. I don't know, sharing expertise.
But yeah, I really appreciate that. And I appreciate, you know, reading your book, and I'm going to go back through it again. There's more to pick up there. And I'm sure that people listening will get a lot of value. One last thing, do you have anywhere to point people in terms of your work and the projects that you're working on at the moment?
Yeah, the big thing that Daniel 3 is working on is the EPRC, theeprc.org, and ebenefactors.org. If you're in a contributing mood, donate to us, help us with this project to upgrade the clinical mainstream's relationship to the deep end, broadly defined. Thank you. I would also, like you were mentioning the book and stuff, I would like to thank all the countless people that created the wisdom and the breadcrumbs that I was able to follow. Like, I was not smart enough to figure the stuff out de novo, but I could definitely follow instructions,
mm-hmm.
You know, and, you know, get some results. So that's the next thing, of just acknowledging the millennia of conversations of countless nameless jungle practitioners and cloistered monastics and wild wandering sadhus and everybody else that helped contribute to this.
Mm-hmm.
And just thank you to all of you for listening. Thank you to you for taking the time and for inspiring a really fun conversation and lending so many great points and perspectives on it. So thanks.
Been an absolute pleasure, Daniel, and I look forward to us talking again.
And thank you to all of you in podcast land for listening to this.
Yes. I
hope it was useful. And if not, let it go. Find something else. Lots of good stuff out there.
Yeah, be equanimous towards it. If you didn't like it straight away, just throw it in the bin.
Hold it lightly.
Yeah.
All right.
Awesome.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Mind That Ego podcast. To stay up to date, you can join the Mind That Ego mailing list if you head to mindthatego.com/MFM. You'll also get a copy of my book,
mindsets for mindfulness when you join. You can also follow Mind That Ego on Facebook and YouTube, where the podcasts are also displayed in video format along with other inspired videos that I create. Or if Instagram is more your social media of choice, you can follow me at Ricky_DeRiz. That's DERISZ.